and welcome to this week's Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. My name is Sean Delaney, and Inside Education is a weekly beacon of insight and inspiration into aspects of teaching and learning. You can download podcasts of over 350 previous episodes at seandelaney.com/podcasts. On this week's programme, I'm delighted to bring you two more interviews from keynote speakers at the 2019 Annual Conference of the Irish Primary Principals Network, the IPPN. Later on the programme, we'll hear from Adam Harris from As I Am. But first, I'll speak to Professor Patrick O'Shea, President of University College Cork. Patrick O'Shea had a three-decade career in academia in the United States, at the University of Maryland, at the University of California, and at Duke University, before becoming the 15th president of University College Cork in 2017. I began our conversation by asking him what his message was for the principals he addressed at the IPPN conference.
Schools are places where societies invest in nurturing the talent that we need to tackle the challenges and opportunities of the future. And so the primary school teachers will play a key role as leaders in the formation of Ireland's youth to take advantage of the future Ireland of opportunity, as I like to call it. So they're at the front line.
And what kind of opportunities do you see are there for the next generation of Irish citizens?
Well, Ireland is increasingly becoming a global country. And that's really clear to me since I've come back. You know, I spent 30 years in America and now I'm coming back. And I'm seeing all the opportunity. And I'll take Brexit as an example. A lot of people view Brexit as a crisis, but I view that as a tremendous opportunity for Ireland and for Irish education, because a lot of students who used to go to Britain for education are now looking to come to Ireland. So at UCC, for example, we've seen a factor of three increase in the number of foreign applicants in the past 2 years since Brexit. So a lot of people view Ireland as a safe place to live, to learn, to work, and to grow.
And you've mentioned there your time in the United States, and you've just relatively recently returned. What has struck you about the Ireland you've returned to, and also how it compares with your experience of university in the United States?
It's a completely different place. As a famous writer once said, the past is a foreign country. They do things differently there. And people have said to me, oh, it must be great to be coming home. And I say, it's coming home again for the first time. Everything is different. You know, hardly anybody gets chilblains anymore. A mixed grill is no longer haute cuisine. Things are tremendously more optimistic than they were when I left. There's way more opportunity. I mean, I left Ireland in 1980 because after I graduated from university, the number of opportunities I had were very limited. But now I come back and I see the creative nature of the economy, the entrepreneurial nature of the economy, the positive attitude, and I think it's really boding well for the future of Ireland.
You were an engineer. You qualified as an engineer, is that right?
I actually qualified as a physicist, curiously enough. But I've morphed myself into an engineer. So I've managed to become a professor of electrical and computer engineering. And I was also the leader of one of the world's leading departments of electrical and computer engineering without ever actually having taken courses in either subject, which is quite a trick.
And how did you find the academic culture, the university culture in the United States?
I found it to be amazingly creative and amazingly open. What really impressed me was the willingness of people to work across boundaries and outside of their core disciplines, and to be accepting of different creative and unusual ideas. And that's what I really liked. There was no real siloing of departments. It was really big teamwork, to use an Irish word, a mettle. You know, everybody working together.
And what aspects of that are you going to bring as priorities to leadership of University College Cork?
Well, you know, our mission is really very simple. It's to create, to educate, and to deliver. And to do that, we need people, places, and programs, okay? And so what I want to do is to create an environment where education and creative research are not separate activities. That, you know, in our new curriculum, we're having an education program which is directly based on creative research by the students. Getting to the point where in the future, the idea of sitting in a classroom will be obsolete. That learning can occur without teaching. Okay? And then the next part of that is connecting that to the outside world, the delivery, the practical nature of the education. So a lot of the new things we're doing are connected in to the vibrant life of the city. For example, UCC has a new partnership with the Cork Opera House, which is a major theatre. And that partnership, part of it is to help educate and train students in the management of performing arts in a real, living, messy, complex theatre, as opposed to just doing it, you know, in a student theatre. So that's an example of the kind of thing we're doing, is to connect creativity and creation of knowledge with the education, and then the connection of that into the real world in terms of creating value in the real world.
And if you can see learning happening without teaching, who directs the learning?
Well, of course, we have lecturers and professors who work to provide guidance. Obviously, there have to be goals. There has to be accountability in the sense there have to be exams at the end. But there is more than one way to get to that goal. So the teacher, the educator, as it were, provides goals. But then we want to leave it up to the student to find their particular pathway to achieve that goal. So it's not so much directing the path. It's showing the goal and then allowing the students with support to get there. So I like to say we're educating explorers, not simply training tourists. A tourist has a map. It's very structured. An explorer has a goal, like the top of Mount Everest, the South Pole. They know the endpoint. They're not sure how to get there, and there's more than one way to get there. And we want to support that diversity of thought, which is the future. You know, the future for a resilient economy, a resilient culture, is to have a lot of diversity of approach. Because if you have a monoculture, you fail. And we learned that during the famine, when we were all invested in potatoes. And so I want to create students who are capable of navigating an uncertain world and making decisions without complete data sets. Because that's real life. You never really know what's going on. Take Brexit as a good example right now. Nobody knows what's going on. But there's huge opportunity buried in that for people who are willing to seize it. And that's the kind of thing we want to educate our students to do. Not simply give them raw skills, but an education that allows them to observe the world, to question the world, to analyze the world, to reflect on that analysis, and then to take action.
I can see that working well for students who are motivated, but not all students are equally motivated to learn, even when they're on courses that are difficult to enter. How would you motivate students, or where would the motivation come from for the less motivated students?
Everybody has a motivation. The question is to find that motivation. What makes people tick? That's why our support services are very important, to really understand what motivates people. If we have a very narrow set of criteria, of course, you'll find that very few people may satisfy that criteria. But we want to, let's say, support neurological diversity. That is, people who have different motivations. We all have different motivations. And part of our goal is to understand how that ticks. And that's how, say, departments of education and universities become very important, that they understand how to get to the motivation of every person. Because I guarantee you, we're all motivated to do things. It's just a question of understanding how to unlock and unleash that motivation.
You mentioned there the School of Education in the university, and very often, particularly in the United States, the School of Education is a school of lower status compared to some of the other schools in the university. How do you view the School of Education in your university, and more generally, what is the role of a School of Education in a university?
Well, UCC has had a School of Education for a very long time. In fact, it's quite historic in that one of the first women professors ever appointed in any university in these islands was a professor of education, Elizabeth O'Sullivan, at UCC in 1910. And then, you know, understanding how pedagogy works, transmitting that not just within the university but down into the schools, and understanding not just how to teach students but also how to educate educators is a very important part of it. So the creative aspect of pedagogy, the academic aspect of it, the research aspect, is critical to any successful academic department. So it's more than simply training teachers, as it were. It's actually creating the new methodologies, creating the new pedagogies, testing new, original, maybe even crazy ideas, and then distilling those down and helping to pass those on to the primary and secondary school teachers.
You're here today to address primary school principals. How is leadership of a primary school similar to or different from leading a university?
It's very similar, except we even have more of it, you know. Sometimes you're leading a university is described as being like herding cats, you know, or nobody's really listening. But I deal with newborn babies in our maternity hospital. We have a research center all the way up to our oldest alumna, Maureen Hughes, who graduated in 1935 and is 104 and a half. Okay, so it's complicated. I mean, I've got 22,000 students, 3,000 staff, so it's the size of the city of Kilkenny. So I have it all, you know, and some of the aspects it include dealing with behaviors of people, which you would find in a primary school.
So what is a typical day like for you then in that work?
I'm in the office by about 7:30 in the morning. So, you know, come in, get an early morning greeting and briefing from my senior staff about what's happened the night before, because, you know, it's a 24/7 operation. I mean, the research is going on day and night. The students are around day and night because we obviously have students living on campus. So get a briefing as to what's happened, if there's any action needs to be taken, and then begin to move into the daily meetings with the management team, with professors, and then visitors. We have visitors every day, from ambassadors to government ministers, but the visitors I enjoy most are the visitors from the primary schools, because we have what we call a junior conferring at UCC. So every day we'll bring in maybe 100 or so 8, 9 or 10 year olds. We dress them up in academic gowns and we show them around the university so they can understand what they can aspire to in 8 to 10 years. So they think they're in Hogwarts because, you know, UCC looks like a movie version of a university in many respects. And so the students just love it there. So that is really the joy of my day when I meet the students or when I look out my window and see them walking around so full of life.
Do you find it difficult to separate the urgent work from the important work? You know, do you find yourself being dragged down into kind of lower order activities, whereas of its nature, being president of a university, you have to keep an eye on the big picture?
You have to keep an eye on the big picture. And I mean, that you're exactly right. It's there's so much noise out there that you can really get distracted from the noise and not see the signal. And, you know, history is what's left when the noise of the news has disappeared. So you have to see the big signal and not get dragged down in the daily, you know, goings on, because there is so much chatter out there, and I try to filter that out. What are the big rocks? Somebody once told me, if you're trying to put rocks into a jar, put the big rocks in first, and the small ones will take care of themselves. And so I try to focus on the big long-term picture and not get dragged down by, you know, the day-to-day stuff that happens, because it can really drag you down. And, you know, when I go home, I like to be at home. In a sense, I was talking to the former president of Harvard about this when I went to Harvard for training 2 years ago, and Drew Faust is her name, and she said, you know, when she goes home, she watches Breaking Bad or some other movie like that, just to disconnect and maintain focus. Maintain focus on what's important. And I look back, you know, I've read a lot about the history of universities and the history of my predecessors, and you read all about all of these fights and other things that went on that nobody remembers today. Nobody cares. So, you know, don't take it personally when somebody starts complaining. Try to find out what's really going on.
So that comes back to your quote that history is what's left when the
noise of the news is gone. I mean, that's basically what it is. And you can see a lot of that today in the current news that we see about Brexit, which conveys no information. But in a year or two, we'll know what's going to happen. So I try to not get overly focused on the daily back and forth and focus on the opportunity, for example, that it brings to UCC, because the chaos in Britain is huge opportunity, not just for UCC, but for Ireland in general, as an example, right? And that's about it.
And that was Professor Patrick O'Shea from University College Cork. Adam Harris is the Chief Executive Officer of As I Am, a charity and advocacy organisation for people with autism in Ireland. Adam was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome at an early age, and his experiences growing up inspired him to establish As I Am while studying for his leaving certificate. When I look for suggested guests on the programme, Adam's name has been suggested in the past, so I was delighted to meet him at the IPPN conference. I first asked him to outline his message for Irish primary school principals.
My message is that in the last 10 or 15 years, a huge amount of progress has been made in terms of the first step to inclusion, which is what I would call permission. Permission to enter a building, permission to be part of a school. You know, we've moved from a point when I was a young child where a very small number of people who are autistic or who had Asperger's syndrome would be able to attend their local school. And we've moved from that point to a point that 86% of children attend mainstream school, either in an autism class or in the mainstream class. So that's progress. But I think where there's a real challenge now is to ensure that the quality of the experience of an autistic person is the same as the quality of experience of their neurotypical peer. And I think principals play a really important role in kind of leading inclusion within their school and ensuring that inclusion isn't just left to one teacher or to one classroom, but that it's something that really touches on every single member of the school community. So that's what I'm looking forward to sharing with how that's possible this morning.
And could you give an example of how it is possible, either what a teacher can do or what a principal can do?
So I think it starts very simply at the language we use. So for example, at the moment we talk so much about autism units, which gives you all sorts of connotations. Or we talk about children with autism spectrum disorders. So I think part of it's about how we change our language, how we talk about people within the school community who are autistic. The second thing I think is really important is that it's as important to educate peers as it is to educate teachers about what it's like to be autistic. So I think it's really important that from the word go, autism is normalised, autism is something that's talked about as a mainstream part of diversity, which it is. I think the second piece that needs to be done, while there's been a lot of progress around educating specialist teachers in the field, a lot more needs to be done to ensure that every classroom teacher has, I suppose, a universal understanding of it, an entry-level understanding of disability. One of the things we're working on and we'll be launching later this year is a resource for schools that will define for the first time what is an autism-friendly school and will give schools a toolkit to implement it mapped to the existing inspectorate standards. And that's something we think is really helpful, very practical. And included in that will be 3 free online hours of training for every teacher in the country. So we hope this was something that will make it free and easy for teachers to learn that really important information about how they can include autistic students in their class.
And what was your own experience as an autistic student in primary school?
Well, I suppose I had the full 360 because I spent the first 3 years of my education in special school and then the next 5 years in primary school with an SNA, and then I went to secondary school independently. So I suppose I've seen it from so many angles. I was really fortunate, I think, to go to a school that really wanted to work with me and to work for me. I was one of the first people who'd been mainstreamed into that school. And, you know, when I meet parents, they often want to talk about where will I send my child to school? And we talk about SNAs and we talk about autism classes and all that really important stuff. But I always say that's really only the second part of the discussion, because you can have schools that have all those things that really still don't perform for an autistic student. The most important thing is school culture, which can be a very difficult thing to define or to measure. It's a kind of feeling as much as anything else. But I think about the school that I went to and the principal that I had, Eileen Jackson, St. Patrick's and Greystones, where really they just tried to meet me where I was at and to take a strengths-based approach to autism. A key characteristic of autism is that people have scattered skill sets. So we're very good at what we're good at and we're very bad at what we're disinterested in or not good at. Unfortunately, what we sometimes do is we sit down and we make a snag list of all the things the person can't do and focus on those. Whereas really what we have to try and do is find out what the person's interested in and focus on those and work through those. So for example, one of the things that I was really positive about my school, when I moved at 8, I still couldn't really read or write, but I had this huge interest and fascination in facts and history and anything like that. So they taught me how to read and write by doing history projects. They'd have me present these projects to the class so that students would see me be good at something instead of bad at something. And really, they tried to weave that into every part of my education. So they focused on the strengths. And that's so important, A, in terms of getting results, but I think also in terms of the self-esteem of the student. I think where we do have work to do still on primary school level is people always ask me, you know, when did you find out about the fact that you were autistic? This is probably the question I get asked most. And my parents always talked about it openly. And I was always comfortable with it till I was around 11 or 12, and I began to really understand the idea of difference more. And I remember by the time I was supposed preparing for secondary school, I didn't want to talk about autism at all. And what I think is very interesting is if we look at some of the research that ASAM has done at a university level, where we're seeing 50% of students say, I've never told anyone on campus that I'm autistic. And one of the key reasons is when I said it in school, I didn't like how I was supported. I was made feel more different. I felt that I was kind of patronizer. I felt, you know, I felt that I was made to feel more different, or that my peers, my differences were highlighted to my peers. So I think one of the things we need to do is, as children become more self-aware, to really proactively involve them in the decision-making process around how they're supported. Because if we don't get that right at primary school level, there's a risk that later in life people don't take the help that they need.
And what was your experience like of working with a special needs assistant in primary school particularly?
So I had a really positive experience, and I actually had the same SNA for 5 years. And that gave me a great kind of consistency and reliability. There was a lot of change of teachers, and there was this one person who I suppose got to know me and understand me better than anybody else. And I think that was critically important. So it was a really positive thing for me, and I think it put me in a position that I was able to go to secondary school without SNA support. So in a sense, it was a real example of the system working. And I think though what we need to make sure is that not every student feels that way, and it doesn't always work that way. So what I think we need to ensure is that students are involved in decisions around where they want the SNA to sit. Do they want an SNA or not? What's the role of the SNA in the student's life? So I think that's something that requires a bit of work and attention.
And the student should be involved in that?
I think very much so, because if we don't, we run the risk of the person dismissing their support that they need later in life, and we're seeing that again and again and again. It's a very personal thing, and I think, you know, who knows better than the person who's experiencing it.
And how did it work best for you? Was the SNA sitting beside you?
Well, I think one of the things that was really great about my SNA is she kind of, I suppose, nearly worked herself out of the job, in that when I would have started in second class, she was the person sitting next to me all of the time. By the time I was in sixth class, she really didn't get in my way until I came to look for something for her. So we had a very strong relationship, and that's why it worked. So I think the relationship element is important. I know the advice now is to rotate SNAs, and I understand that, but I do sometimes feel we go from one extreme to the other, to you'll always have the one SNA and it's specifically for you, to you should never have one and it's not for you. So I think we need to find a halfway house. We kind of sometimes go a bit one way or the other in Ireland.
Could you say a little bit about the work of ASAM?
Yeah, so ASAM is an organisation I founded 5 years ago. It's now the country's largest autism charity. We have a team of 13 staff. And I suppose our vision is to bring about an autism-friendly Ireland. So I guess what we would say is awareness, we've actually achieved that objective. But there's a big difference between awareness and understanding. So I'm aware that Mandarin is a language, but I don't understand it. So I'm not much used to anyone who only speaks that language. So I think a really important piece of work is that needs to be done is to ensure that everybody within society has the skills to recognise and support autistic people. I suppose in the same way what we've done about mental health over the last number of years. So our charity has two things. One, we build the capacity of the autism community. That's through a lot of activities every NGO does, lobbying, supporting families, organising events. But the other thing that makes us really unique is we reach out into the community and we educate people about how they can be more autism friendly. So we do teacher training. We work with students in schools to address the bullying problem. But we even work with the whole community. So we designated Clonakilty as Ireland's first autism friendly town earlier this year. We also developed a framework with DCU to make it the world's first autism friendly university. And we're now supporting a number of universities around Ireland and indeed beyond who want to join that family of universities.
And you've said that teacher training is part of the work of ASAM. What does the teacher training part involve?
So I suppose the big thing that ASAM always wants to get across is empathy. So I think often what we so much focus on in our training is the facts and approaches, and all that's very important. But for me, the critical difference between will a person be included or not is, does a person empathise with the experience? If you're a neurotypical person, it's very hard to actually understand what the sensory environment is like, to understand why a person behaves in a certain way. So I suppose our training, we do a lot of Crow Park hours, focuses on this piece around trying to give people the empathy of understanding what the experience is like, because I think when we can build empathy, that's so important. Often autistic people are seen as these people who don't understand empathy. We like to see it as a double empathy problem. Often we can struggle to understand neurotypical behaviour, but equally neurotypical people can find it hard to understand autistic behaviour. So we need to build a bridge.
How do you experience, say, in an environment like this, say, for example, where it's very crowded, a lot of people around? What kind of...
Well, thank God for the green room. But I suppose one of the things I say about autism is a lifelong condition, so it never goes away. So the challenges that I had as a young child, I still experience now. But I suppose thanks to the support I received at a young age, I've learned skills to better manage those. I'll give you an example. If I was younger, if I went into a very noisy environment, I'd get extremely frustrated and I'd probably experience a major meltdown. Later on today, I'm going to New York for a conference, and that's, no, I'm not looking forward to it at all, because I find it a very stressful city, lots of change, lots of things happening, not a very kind place, people in your face. But I carry special earphones that are the same members of a band wear, so I can still hear everything, but it takes all the edge off, and that's hugely helpful. I go out with my friends, but when I go out, I take breaks during the night to just calm down a little bit. I still experience a lot of anxiety and a lot of organisational problems, but you learn ways to manage it. And I suppose, as I said, I think this links to teachers as well. When we find at a young age children identify a coping mechanism, we need to make sure we don't unteach that coping mechanism. So to give you an example, if I want to concentrate, one of the things that helps me is to take my shoes off. Now, obviously, if you're in a crowded corridor, you have to wear shoes. But if someone's sitting at their desk and that helps them to concentrate, that's a good thing. When I was in preschool, and if you look at some of the footage of me in preschool that was in the Autism and Me documentary on RTE Player, you'll see that I used to spend a lot of time barricading myself away from the other students. And of course, the effort was to pull me back into the group. But then I spent years in therapy where they tried to explain to me if I was getting frustrated and anxious, I should get away and not stay in the thing. So when a person identifies a coping mechanism and it's not preventing participation, it's not stopping them do things, it's not affecting other people, it's something we should encourage, not discourage.
And how early did your diagnosis come?
So I was diagnosed at 4.5. My parents really knew from the word go. I was the third child in the family and the second boy. And often if you're the first child, parents can miss the signs. Or if you're the first boy, you can attribute a lot of the things to just boyish behaviour. But I think very early on, my mom knew. I was very late being born. I had a huge attachment to her from the moment I was born. She couldn't put me out of her arms for 2 seconds without me getting very frustrated. Didn't sleep in my own bed till I was 7. As my mother always asked me to point out, it wasn't from a lack of trying of hers. Couldn't cope with the sensory environment. Always talking about things I was interested in, but only things I was interested in, which made it hard to make friends or peers. So my parents were asking questions from the time I was about 18 months old, and we finally got the diagnosis then.
And my final question, you've kind of touched on it, but was there a teacher who had a significant impact on you?
Yeah, I think there's two people I'd mention. Eileen Jackson was the principal of the national school that I moved to. And she just was very much a person who gave me the opportunity to move into mainstream. And it was always very supportive of meeting my needs. So she's just somebody I have huge respect and admiration for. In second level, I have a teacher, Trina Brosnan, who taught me how to public speak. So she's to blame for a lot of my advocacy work.
And possibly why you're here today.
And possibly why I'm here today. So we still have a very close relationship to the point that we would still speak once or twice a week. So I'm a big believer in the power of good teachers.
And that advocate for the power of good teachers is autism understanding campaigner Adam Harris, the CEO of As I Am, who I spoke to before his keynote presentation to the Irish Primary Principals Network Conference 2019. That's all for Inside Education this week. Remember, you can listen back to previous episodes by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on the podcasts tab. My book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is available from good libraries and online bookstores. I'll be back at the same time next week. Thank you for listening.